Okay, this is, I guess, the fourth lecture in computational biology. First of all, are there any questions from previous classes or lectures or anything like that? Okay, we've got a couple of announcements. First, we have today I'm giving out the first homework assignment. There's copies of it in the back of the room on one of the chairs if people haven't picked it up yet. And this will be due in about 2.5 weeks. The important thing about the most important thing is that this is going to be done in groups of 2 or 3 people. And every group has to contain one life science person and one computational science person. How many people here, and be honest and complete, how many people here consider themselves to be life science people? Raise your hands if you're a life science person. So I'm seeing only 3 of them, okay? I know that there are more of you, and you can define your notion of life science in a fairly broad way. An undergraduate degree in life science is acceptable. Someone who's in biomedical engineering or something like that is a life science person, okay? I want every group to contain at least one life science person and at least one computational person. Now let's check it again. How many people are life science people? Raise your hands proudly. Are there any more? We have made more life science people, okay, this way. There's at least one more. Okay, it's important that we make life science people, okay? So you figure out who a life science person is and join that. The life science people will have less to do on these assignments. So in some sense, they're more, the assignments are more geared towards the computational people, okay, if you wish. So it's important, though, that there be some consulting done in by a life science person. So I encourage you to find such people and mate with them. Again, there's a group of 3 people means 2 computational persons to 1 life science person is fine. Okay, but it's important you find a living life science person. Okay, any questions? The bulk of this first assignment is going to be to do experiments with an assembler program. You can read that the assignments offline. But basically, it's going to ask you to do experiments with an assembler program that I have put on the web. This was a good assembly program for small projects. It's about a 10-year-old program, something called CAP2. And I want you to experiment with it and to determine what the impact of sequencing error rates, coverage, and random genomes versus mammalian genomes, what impact that has on assembly. And the goal of this assignment is each group will write a report about what their experiments were and what they learned. Okay, the assignments are left intentionally somewhat vague, okay, or open-ended is probably a better word for it. Okay, so I want every group to, to do some experimenting and see what you learn. One thing that I have found in the past is that computer scientists have a very limited idea of what it means to conduct experiments with a program. The goal is to try to answer questions, not just generate numbers. Computer scientists are very good at running programs and getting numbers from them. Okay, they're a lot less good at thinking about what the numbers mean, whether they tell a story or not, what other story, experiments you can run to tell a better story. And that's the kind of thing that I'd like to see people try to develop here. So one of the major parts of the problem is to do experiments with an assembler. Some other things I want you to do is to spend some time playing with some of the databases that we talked about, GenBank and SwissProt and PubMed, and so at least superficially play around with them for an hour or so, just to sort of get a feel what's there. And finally, there are a couple of analytical problems at the end of the assignment that I want people to play around with. But any questions? So try to mate into groups. The assignment is due in about 2.5 weeks. It's on the October 8th. I want you to mate with your partners. And those who have not yet mated with partners, we will try to mate people with partners next class. But I encourage you to find your own partners, because it's less painful that way. Any questions? Okay? Question?
Can we group the guy who will take this one on one
thing? Yeah, so the question is, can you make this course, take find a partner who's not taking the course for credit? I think that's a very good thing to do, if that person is, if you can do that, that sounds very good. Again, hopefully that's the case, that's the life science people. mostly. And so that may be another way to get, make more life science people. I think there are a lot more auditors from the life science people than people take it for credit. Okay? And any questions? Okay? The other thing is that we have succeeded in putting the first lecture of audio, the last lecture, is now on, the audio is now on the web. And so hopefully that will become a well-established technology. How many people listened to it? I heard at least one person did. Exactly one person did. And so it seemed to work. You don't have any obligation to listen to it, but I'd like to know if it's working or anything like that. Question? A group cannot be more than three people at this point, okay? I may or may not insert people into groups, okay? But that would be a painful operation. So I think we're going to want to have three groups of at most three people. I don't think it's helpful to have more than that, really. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Good. So, okay. So, last class, we had talked a little bit about, we started to talk about assembly, the problem of assembly. And what I had started to, what did we learn from last time? We should believe that now the way that you can sequence large things is to use these sequencing machines to get reads of about 500 base pairs long and rely on overlaps and using the overlap information to put the pieces into larger assemblies. Okay, and ideally if you have enough sequenced data, enough reads, okay, you should with high probability be able to reconstruct the sequence pretty accurately. Okay, but if we didn't have enough sequencing data, there was going to be gaps in our assembly. Just because, you know, if you're randomly sampling from the genome, it's going to be the case that there's going to be places where you don't sample, okay, you know, regions where you don't have any fragments. If you sample at unless you sample at a high enough rate, okay. So the problem that we had last time was that this amount of coverage, essentially the number of times you have to sequence the genome, the length of the genome, with fragments before you can expect to cover all the gaps, grows with the length of the genome, okay. And so there are two possible approaches. One is you sequence it in the shotgun manner, with a lot of, with a high amount of coverage, okay? The other approach was to try to do something smarter than shotgun sequencing, some more laboratory work to try to cut down the amount of raw sequence data you need, okay? And I told you that there were two groups that were trying to sequence the human genome basically simultaneously. One was this company, Celera, which did the basically pure shotgun strategy. The other group, the public group, used a combination of shotgun sequencing and mapping data to try to sequence the genome. I just wanted to talk briefly about this idea of using mapping data. Okay, what kind of data might be available and what computational problems come up in trying to assemble it. So what would be the public consortium's idea? They saw that formula we saw last time, the Lander-Waterman equation, which said that unless you sequence the human genome 30 times, 50 times, you're going to have a lot of gaps, okay? And gaps are a big problem. So what they said is, why don't we break the human genome into a smaller number of pieces, okay? A smaller number of large pieces, okay, where each piece was maybe a million bases long, something in that range, okay? Figure out what the order of those large pieces are without sequencing them, okay? So we can identify a small number of pieces such that it would be sufficient to sequence just these pieces, and that then we would have enough information to reconstruct the entire genome. Okay? They were hoping to reduce the amount of sequencing they needed because the sequencing was going to be reduced to these small pieces, which were about one megabase long, that could be sequenced independently. And the amount of coverage you need goes down in sequencing a small project over a big project. So the question is, could they figure out from large pieces of size 1 million or so, could you figure out the order of how they go on the genome without sequencing them? Once they're sequenced, it's easy. It's the same problem we had before of trying to find an overlap between this and an overlap between that. And certainly if these are a million characters long, if they overlap by half, that's half a million characters in a row that are the same, we could do a good job of finding the order of them. But the question is, can we figure out the order of these pieces called clones, okay, without actually sequencing them? And the way that we did that, or the way that they did that, was to try to construct something they would call, to basically obtain what they would call mapping information. And I always found the idea of mapping a little bit confusing, okay? But the basic technique would be this. You would conduct some kind of an experiment, okay, to ask whether a sequence, you now have a library of 10,000 clones, 100,000 clones in front of you, each in its own test tube, okay? And you would want to ask for each clone, does it contain a particular short sequence? Okay? So the question is, could you do an experiment that, given a DNA molecule, could test whether it has a particular short sequence? Okay? There are a couple of ways that you could do this kind of experiment, at least conceptually. One is based on hybridization. Does anyone remember, we've used the word hybridization before. Does anyone remember what hybridization is? Okay. It's the idea that a molecule will bind to its sort of its opposite, its complementary pair. What if, let's say, we did the following experiment, at least conceptually. We have a short piece of DNA with a particular pattern that we know nailed down to a plate. And we now pour our clone, a mixture of our DNA with a particular clone in it. Okay, maybe we radio-label this thing. Okay? If this fragment appears in this molecule, okay, if this fragment is the complement of one that appears in this molecule, we would expect them to stick together. And now by detecting whether or not there is radiation at the point where we put this probe, we can at least conceptually figure out, does the complement of that sequence occur in the molecule? Does everybody at least buy that kind of a technology conceptually? So this gives us a laboratory technique to ask the question, is this fragment in that molecule? Okay? That's one way you could do it. Another way you can do it is with a technology that's fairly common, something called restriction enzymes. There are certain chemicals, certain enzymes, which have the property that they cut DNA at specific patterns. Okay? So there might be an enzyme, GAATTC, let's say. Okay? There's an enzyme, I think an enzyme called ECHO-R1. Cuts DNA whenever it sees the pattern GAATTC. So what could we do? If we want to ask the question, does the molecule contain this pattern? What could we do? We could take any ideas how we could use the fact that an enzyme can cut at a particular pattern to test for the presence of that pattern? Yeah? Exactly right. We know how to measure the length of these things. For certain patterns, we know how to cut at that pattern. Okay? We could conceivably ask this molecule, hey, do you have this pattern? By exposing it to the enzyme, if it doesn't have that pattern, it isn't cut. If it does have that pattern, it is going to be cut. And we know that this pattern occurs there. Okay? So basically, this gives us a way to tell if a molecule has a pattern, a particular site. What is the case if two clones overlap? Okay? If I have two clones that occur on the genome in a way that they overlap, these are all close to, let's say, a million bases long, a million bases long. If I ask, do you have this particular sequence? If they have that sequence in the overlap region, then they will even tell basically, hey, that makes it likely that they probably overlap, right? Or they might overlap. If on the other hand, neither of these sequences contain the, the overlap, the segment we're querying. Okay, well, maybe they overlap.
If one of them does and one of them doesn't, well, we're pretty sure that they don't over, they don't, that site does not occur in the overlap between the patterns. Does everybody sort of see that? That should be pretty clear.
So what is the mapping data? Okay, basically it's going to give us for all pairs of clones. You might learn, do these two have something in common which suggests that they overlap? Okay, or they might overlap. Maybe you have a bunch of these little probes. And if you have enough probe things in common, maybe you say, yeah, I think this overlaps that. The question is, given a graph, a computer science-y type graph, where the vertices are clones, and the edges are, yeah, we think there's an edge between I and J if they likely overlap. Can we then figure out an ordering of the clones from left to right, such that that explains the mapping data? Okay?
And once we have such an ordering, let's say we now have this ordering of all the clones, now maybe I can pick a small subset of fragments. Maybe I'll pick this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. And know that if I sequence just these, since I know this has to overlap that, and this has to overlap that, that will be enough information for me to sequence the whole thing. Okay, does everybody get an idea of conceptually what the idea is? Okay. So in principle, this is a smarter way to look at it. Okay. You're doing more laboratory work, but your hope is to reduce the amount of sequencing you need. Because first of all, you're not going to actually sequence all of these guys. And second, these individual things you are going to sequence are a lot smaller, and so you need less coverage to do that. Any questions? How reliable are the results from this mapping data? Well, the answer is, as always, somewhat...
Oh, sorry. This is more pattern, I'm guessing that might be.
So the question is, how accurate is the information about from mapping? The answer is it depends. Okay, I mean it's good, but it's not perfect. Okay, and that's actually an important difference algorithmically. Okay, so if we take a look at the problem of given clone order, okay, given basically this mapping information, which I like to think of as a graph, okay, that tells me where the vertices are fragments, okay, or clones. There is an edge between every pair of clones that looks like that overlaps. Suppose we know that. The process of reconstructing the order of the clones from left to right, okay, happens to be the same as, if we assume no error or anything else, a famous graph algorithm problem. Okay, that of retesting whether a graph is what we call an interval graph. How many people here have ever heard of interval graphs? Anybody? One, two, a few people admit it. Okay? So an interval graph is a graph with the property that it is defined by a set of segments on a line, and there is where every vertex represents a segment, and there is an edge between any two segments if they overlap. Okay? And so the interval graph problem, recognition problem, is given a graph, can you find an interval model for those vertices? Okay, that explains that graph. For this particular graph of two cliques separated by a path, this sequence of intervals does it. Here we have five vertices all that overlap each other. A sequence of five edges that all share a common point will define five segments, all that have a common point, define that left clique. Now I have a path. If I have a bunch of segments that only overlap each other in a path like I have here, before I get down to the business of having another clique, I can recognize this graph as an interval graph. Okay? Does everybody see that this graph can be explained by segments? Can anybody come up with a graph that cannot be explained by a model of segments? Is it true that every graph has a set of segments assigned to vertices that could represent that topology? Okay. Anybody give me an example of a graph that maybe can't do it? Okay. Any ideas? Okay.
What about a graph, let's say that this was four vertices in a cycle? Is it possible to represent four vertices in a cycle as an interval model? Well, let's think about it. Let's say this is A, B, C, and D. Here's segment A. Segment B has to overlap it. Segment C has to overlap B, but not A. That seems to mean we got to put segment C here. But now we're in trouble. Where is segment D going to go? If I have a segment D has to overlap both A and C, but in the process I'm stuck, it's also going to overlap B, right? Does everybody agree with that? So some graphs have the property that they're interval graphs, some properties graphs don't. Okay? And it's not obvious how to tell which is, you know, whether given a graph, whether it is an interval graph. Okay? It's not obvious, but there is a set of conditions that are known. And in fact, there is a linear time algorithm for, given a graph, recognizing whether it is an interval graph. Okay, it's a fairly complicated algorithm, and proving the correctness of it is not simple. Okay? So in principle, if I gave you the mapping data that was completely, perfectly accurate, okay, I could find the ordering of those fragments, okay, correctly and efficiently. The problem is, of course, that these mapping data is testing whether one molecule intersects another molecule. There are problems, there's errors and things like that. And when you start trying to incorporate error to the model, not recognizing an exact interval graph, but recognizing an almost interval graph, that's enough to make the computational problems hard. Okay? So there's a certain literature on trying to solve these mapping problems. Okay? It should be clear that they sort of look like Hamiltonian cycle problems, Hamiltonian path problems, because you want to find an ordering from left to right that visits all of these guys. Okay? But again, there's errors. Sometimes the edges aren't really there, problems like that. And so that's what makes them hard. Any questions? Yes?
Any graph in the cycle, or any graph in the cycle, you can't have a
any graph with an induced cycle of length greater than 3 cannot be done. If we add other edges to the cycle, okay, so something like this. Here's a graph, a complete graph on 4 vertices, still has that cycle, okay, and yet it does have an interval model because they all those points things share a point.
But a cycle which has no chords or edges in between other vertices except the cycle, you're in trouble. Okay? Question?
Is it possible that segment D has some inherent problem with A and C but not with B?
Okay, is it possible that segment... Okay, say that again.
Segment D.
D. Yeah?
Yeah.
Has
found inherent problem with segment A.
Okay, so what you're saying is the following. If we had, we could have such a cycle or such a pattern if they were bad edges, if there were edges missing from the graph. We're assuming in the case of interval graph recognition, an edge between A and B means that they do overlap. Now you're saying if we're interpreting the data incorrectly, that we don't know that they really overlap. Well, then we're looking at a different problem. Okay, and that's the problem that turns out to be hard, even though interval graph recognition turns out to be nice. Okay?
Any questions? Okay? But nonetheless, the public consortium used this mapping strategy where they did a lot of experiments to try to identify a map of what fragment likely intersects what clone, meaning a million bases or so, overlaps what other clone. Identify a small set of clones which would be enough that when you sequenced it, you would get everything that you wanted, okay? And then went off and did their business. Okay? Any questions? So those were the two different kinds of strategies. And as you can see, both of them rely on hard problems. But what we are going to be interested in for the next, for now, is not really mapping. We're going to be interested in the shotgun strategy and the question of how do you assemble things from overlaps. So the most natural way, so now I give you a set of fragments here, like here I have fragments of the string abracadabra, okay? The goal is, given a set of fragments, I want to try to reconstruct the order of the fragments. The most natural condition for doing that is to find the shortest common superstring of those fragments. Does everybody sort of agree? I give you as input a bunch of fragments that are, we know are fragments from the string. That's all we know about the string is that they are fragments. We want to now try to figure out what is the order of those fragments on the sequence. Okay? The shortest common superstring is the most natural way to do it. Why not just, why not the longest possible superstring? Longest common superstring. Now, there's lots of that. You can sort of just, you know, sort of permute the fragments randomly. It doesn't tell you anything. Somehow it seems that the most natural explanation would be the shortest possible superstring. Okay? But what may, so this problem we showed, we mentioned, and we almost essentially showed in the second class, is an NP-complete problem. You really are, in this case, trying to find a Hamiltonian path on the graph where the vertices are segments of fragments, and there is an edge from one fragment to another, if and only if they overlap. Okay? So that problem is hard, okay, to compute. But that's not the biggest problem we have in fragment assembly. Another problem we have is that, of course, these individual strings, these individual fragments that we want to assemble, have errors in them. There's a sequencing error rate per base. Every once in a while, these strings have the wrong characters in place. Okay, maybe 2% of the time, 1% of the time, 5% of the time. Okay? So you've got to deal with the fact that there's significant error in the fragments. Even worse, you've got to deal with the fact that genomes tend to have repeats. Okay? So it's one thing if you're assembling a random string. In a random string, it's not likely to be the case that you have a long string, a very long string that occurs twice in the genome. Why? Well, it's just combinatorics and probability. In fact, there's going to be a homework problem associated with that. Okay? But on a random string, you'll see that it's not very likely that there'd be a long string in common. But remember, this is a real genome, and genomes evolve. And one of the bad things that nature does, okay, at least for sequencing bad things, is that DNA, there tends to be repeats in genomes. Quite often there is a mutation event where one gene may very well be copied into the genome. Okay? And now you've got two copies of that gene. And maybe time goes by and there start to be evolutionary distance differences as every once in a while a mutation happens. And these two copies are going to drift apart. They're not exact copies. Okay? But you get very, very similar repeats, okay, in the genome. And this is going to cause big problems in assembly. Why is that? Because it's not... Because the overlaps between the fragments here and the fragments here, they conceptually are going to overlap a lot. And in fact, the shortest possible explanation for this genome might very well be to cut this gene out of the picture completely, put the extra fragments over here, and stick this extra piece at the end. Okay? Does everybody know that we have a repeat in the genome, a long enough repeat? If we're trying to find the shortest common string, a shorter string that would do it would simply eliminate one of the copies. Okay? And that leads to an incorrect assembly. Okay? So in fact, it turns out to be the case that there are these repeats, and in fact, the shortest common superstring is usually a little shorter than the real sequence, okay, which causes problems, okay, but we'll have to deal with that. Any questions? So these are problems. But that's not the big problem that I really want to talk about today. The biggest problem, as far as I'm concerned, with sequence assembly, especially on the genome level, okay, is that the size of the problem is extremely large. How large is extremely large? Well, when Celera was sequencing the genome, their project contained roughly 26 million fragments. Each fragment was about 500 bases long, a little longer than that, 550 bases on average. Okay? Now, suppose we want to build this overlap graph. Somehow, in order to do the shortest common superstring greedy algorithm we talked about, we have to figure out which pairs of fragments overlap each other. Okay? Namely, we want to figure out, it's important given two fragments,
what is the length of the longest overlap between fragment A and fragment B?
Can someone suggest an algorithm for doing that? I think we mentioned this a little bit. But what is a way, how much time should it take if I give you a fragment of length L and another fragment of length L?
How much time will it take to compute the longest overlap between them? Okay, by a naive algorithm. Okay? Heard L squared. Why is that? Well, we can first ask if they overlap completely. If they overlap completely, we'll test all the characters. There's L of them, right? If they do, then that's great. We now know that they completely overlap. If not, we'll slide the second fragment over by one position. Do they overlap? Okay, yes, no. Okay? Do they overlap? Slide it over again. Okay? And that would give a cost L squared time to do. Does everybody sort of believe that? Now, question. Okay, say that again. Yeah.
And then each one
is
and once
we use the L,
you will
play. I'm going to do it. My basic operation is put fragment A, overlap fragment B, overlap them where there's an offset of I, let's say, characters.
And then somehow count the number of base, if I want to do an exact match, I now have to test if the jth character of the first string is the same, the j plus ith character of the first string is the same as the jth character of the second string. Okay? So that's one test. I'm going to be doing this a total of L minus I times on that particular alignment, but I'm going to be doing this a total of L times. Okay? So it's going to be order of L squared. Yes?
We can easily compute the time on the nanograms.
So the question is, we can reduce the claim is that we can reduce the time to n log n by binary search, and I don't see how you can do that, okay? Because the reason I don't believe that is because the number of matches you get does not grow or increase or decrease monotonically. Okay, so I think the idea that you had, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that as I slide the string from left to right, I'm going to be getting more or less matches.
No.
Okay, no.
First stop with combo, and if that works, you do one month and so on. And
So that idea does not work because you don't get a monotonic question. Just because you overlap by, if you have an overlap of length 100, does not mean that you have an overlap of length 100. Okay, and that's why the binary search strategy won't do it. Question?
Could you build like save machine and part of that save machine gets all together?
So the question is, build a state machine. That's something sort of like what we're going to do, okay? But not quite, okay? So the answer may be, depending on how you define state machine, the answer is maybe yes, okay? But any questions? But the naive approach, it should be clear, is that what we could do is check every pair of fragments, each of the 26 million by 26 million fragments against each other. And for each one of those pairs, do our 500 squared computations. If you do that, you can build the overlap graph like we're saying, but it's going to cost us something like 10 to the 20th operations, okay, which is clearly prohibitive, okay? And again, Celera, the company that did this genome sequencing center, is not afraid to do a lot of computation. In fact, they went out and bought what was, I think, supposed to be like the second largest computer operation in the world to do this project. But you couldn't do it, do 10 to the 20th operations, even on the, on that. They did something like, they advertised that they had, that their assembly took 20,000 CPU hours on their supercomputer, doing 500 million trillion base comparisons, okay? But you have to do something smarter than comparing every possible fragment against every possible fragment in the, using the algorithm we showed, okay? So the way that they're going to do it is they're going to use a smart data structure, or we're going to start looking at data structures to help us do this comparison overlap test faster, okay? But it should be clear that this is a serious problem and needs to sort of be done faster, or else the whole method isn't going to work. Any questions? Okay? Again, and in fact, overlap detection, you have to be a little bit careful because you're going to also have sequencing error. So you can't stop when you don't have a perfect exact matching anymore. Okay? You have to also allow overlap testing in a more tolerant environment where you allow error. So exact matching is not going to be the perfect solution to this problem. But I argue it's going to be a substantial part of a good solution. Because even if you have a modest amount of error, you're going to have large exact matches in any sequence. Suppose, let's say, I have an overlap of, 100 bases or so between two fragments. Suppose, let's say, I have a sequencing error rate of 2%. On this fragment, roughly 2 out of every 100 bases are going to go bad. On the other fragment, roughly 2 out of every 100 bases is going to go bad. If you think about it, if you think about the region in common, if we mark the area where there is errors in either sequenced fragment, that's equivalent to an error rate of about of twice that of the original, right? So if we have an error of sequencing rate of 4%, that means that 1 out of every 25 bases is wrong, right? Or equivalently, that means that you would expect that every 25 bases is where you are going to get a wrong answer, which means that you will have runs of sequence, you will have, with high probability, gap regions of at least 25 bases in a row where there is an exact match between the fragments. Does everybody agree with that? That even if you have a 2% error rate on both, that still means you're going to have a reasonably long run of common match between the two fragments exactly. So if we can recognize long exact matches, that will clearly be helpful in deciding whether they overlap. Okay, although that's not going to be sufficient, it's clearly going to be helpful. Any questions? Okay? So what kind of data structures can we use to identify overlaps in strings? Okay, there are a couple of very, very interesting string data structures. Okay? That are somehow they go from being relatively simple to, in my mind, completely amazing. Okay? The first structure that I would talk about for doing string matching is something called a tri. A tri is a tree-like structure. Let's say that you wanted to test whether a word is in a dictionary. Let's say you're building a spelling program, and you have a dictionary of 50,000 words, and you want to read words from the text file that you want to check, and answer, is this word in the dictionary? How might we solve that problem without any fancy data structure? Suppose I give you a table of words in a dictionary. I now want to answer the question, here's a new word. Is it in my dictionary? How might you do that? Okay, over your standard CSE 213 solution. Hash table, that would not be a standard solution, but that's probably not a bad solution. Okay? What was that? You're now sort of, I think, inventing a tribe. Basically, binary search is the first place what I'm looking for is my first answer. If you sorted your strings in the dictionary from, first in alphabetical order to last in alphabetical order, if you have N words in your dictionary, if you want to look up a particular word, you could do it with log N string comparisons. Okay? You ask, is the middle word in my dictionary to the left or to the right of that thing, that strategy? That would give me log N times the length of the string. Or I could hash. That's actually not a bad idea. By hashing, I could hash all the strings into a table, and then in time proportional to the length of the string, with reasonably high probability, I will be able to tell whether it's there or not in constant time. Although there's no guarantees, okay? A tribe is a different approach, okay, for solving the same problem, but I think it's extremely elegant. What a tribe is, we're gonna build a tree where the degree of each node in that tree is the size of my alphabet, okay? And I'm gonna store my string, each word in my dictionary is gonna be stored as a path from root to leaf in the dictionary. So here I have a try on the words there, T-H-E-I-R, there, T-H-E-R-E, the, T-H-E, was, and when. Okay? All those strings begin with either T or W. So the root node only has two nodes, two branches out of it. There's no split on the words that begin with T-H-E, the, there, and there, until we get to the beyond the third position. One string has ended by the third position, so we have to mark the node in here, saying that that T-H-E is in fact a stopping place. But we also have to then split it for new words, okay? Each leaf is going to represent one word. Each root-to-leaf path is going to represent one word. Any questions about what the try is? How do we look up a word in a try? If you want to ask, is our word in the dictionary? How do we do it with this kind of a data structure? Start visiting from the root. Say, let's say I want to look up them. Is them in the dictionary? Well, I ask, is T a character from the root? If so, I'm going to go down to the next node. Is TH a legal path? Yes. THE, yes. THEM, no. Okay? So there I try to find a branch and it's not there. Okay? I will claim that the number of nodes I will have to visit on any comparison is going to be equal to the length of the string at most, right? How much does this depend on the size of the dictionary? Remember, binary search, remember, had a log n term because we had to search. It depended upon how many strings were in the dictionary. How much does this depend upon how many words are in the dictionary? The answer is not at all. Okay? That's actually kind of slick. Okay? The time it's going to take is basically the length of the string times, at each node we might have to compare, depending upon how you arrange the node, it depends upon the size of the alphabet, okay? But all alphabets that we normally deal with are of constant size. For DNA, it's 4. For English, it's 26, okay? So basically, this gives you a double that takes retrieval, does retrieval in the length of the string, basically time proportional to the length of the string. Question? What? So a try is not a good data structure for the Chinese alphabet. Because there you've got a branching factor of 50,000, okay? So that's true, okay? But for most applications, okay, we have relatively small alphabets, okay? And that does tell you that in a lot of string applications, you want to think of your alphabet as small. Now maybe you could use this for Chinese, if you want to recognize that in Chinese, you are probably going to be representing each string as a each character by its binary encoding. Okay, so you could think of it as a binary string, where you know you have a degree 2 tree, and you zip back and forth based on the binary encoding of each character. But still, we're not dealing with Chinese here. We're dealing with mostly DNA and occasionally English. Okay? Any questions? Okay? How would you insert it? How would you build one of these tri-data structures? Okay, suppose I want to insert another word into the dictionary. How do I do it? Just like a binary insertion. Well, not quite a binary insertion. Okay, what I would do is I would march down. Let's say I want to insert them into the tree. I have to march down from root to leaf till I get to the point where there's a split, where I don't find what I want. Then I'm going to take that node and add another branch out from it to my new string. Okay? So my insertion, if I do this right, should take time proportional to the length of the string that I'm inserting, which is somehow optimal. I have to actually read the whole string I'm inserting in order to insert it. I have to read the whole string in order to search for it. Tries are somehow optimal for doing string matching. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so they're a nice simple structure. That should be clear. Any questions? What I'd now like to talk about is a very special type of strings to insert into a tri. Okay, so we have a tri that enables us to do string matching. Is this word, in our dictionary? A suffix tree can be thought of as a tri on all the suffixes of a string. And by the way, if there's any of our life science people here or anybody else who wants to ask questions, don't be shy. Now we're getting into computer science-y kind of things, okay? And we've listened to some of the questions from the CS people, okay? And welcome to hear it from the biology people too. Okay, but a suffix tree is going to be a tri built on all the suffixes of a string. Okay, so let's look at a tri. Let's say our string was XYZ XYZ dollar sign. Dollar sign will denote the end of the string. Okay, and it'll be a unique character, so we know that every suffix is going to be represented by a unique string. Suppose I give you a string of length n, how many suffixes are there of that string? Distinct suffixes. N, or n plus 1 if you want to count the dollar sign, add a dollar sign to the end of it to denote the end of character. So there is the empty string, that would be just sort of the dollar sign. There is the last character followed by the end of string. The last two characters followed by the end of string, dot, dot, dot. You've got basically n plus 1 distinct suffixes of a string of length n. Okay? Suppose we build a tri on just those suffixes. Okay? What does that tri look like? Well, there's going to be the dollar sign character here. That's the empty string, if you look at this particular example. There is z dollar sign. There is YZ dollar sign. There is XYZ dollar sign. Where is that? XYZ dollar sign. There is, what's the other one? There's ZXYZ dollar sign. That's number 3. And so on. Does everybody see how every suffix of the string is represented in this particular suffix tree to the left, to the right? Okay, question. Why does string number 1 not end with dollar sign? The reason is because I made a mistake on the slide. Okay, so it should end with a dollar sign. You're 100% right that this should have a dollar sign here. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So, what is interesting about this tree? Okay? First of all, can we now ask ourselves, what's interesting about this tree is something very amazing. Suppose I want to now know whether or not any particular string occurs anywhere in my text. I can do it. Does the spring Z, X, Y occur anywhere in my text? I claim I can answer that question using the suffix spring. Why is that? Well, if there is a spring that occurs within my text, I claim it has to occur as the prefix of some suffix. Let's think about that for a second. That might be confusing.
Let's say I look at my string, you know, X, Y, Z, X, Y, Z, dollar sign. Does Z, Y, X occur? The answer is yes. How do we prove it? Well, Z, Y, X, if it occurs in the spring, is going to be a prefix of some suffix. Does everybody agree with that? So what do we now know? Now, if you want an algorithm to look at a string and tell me, does this substring occur? I give you an input string, and I give you a query string. And I want to know, does this query string occur anywhere in the string? I claim that you can, once you build the suffix string, you can answer that question in time proportional to the length of the query string. How do we find out whether there's a particular string that occurs? Well, simply look up your query string and start walking from this root of the tree. Is there a match? Okay, if that query string occurs as a substring of your string, it's going to be the prefix of some suffix. And just like we found it in a suffix in a tribe, since this is a tribe of all suffixes, it will be there. Any questions about that? Is that sort of clear and obvious? So this is a very, very neat thing. This enables you to take an entire pattern, a big pattern, let's say a DNA, the genome of an organism, or the Bible, okay? You can build a suffix tree on it, and now, no matter how long that string is, you can now answer the question, does this string contain a particular pattern, and answer it in the length of that pattern. Does everybody see that? Okay. So if you want to ask, does skeena occur in the Bible? Okay. The Bible may be very long. Okay. It's several megabytes. But if I had a suffix tree of it, you could determine that in the length of skeena, S-K-I-E-N-A, and you're going to learn the answer is no. Okay. Any questions about that? So the question is, why isn't there a suffix of length 4? Well, there is a suffix of length 4. Okay, the suffix of length 4 is what? You mean Z, X, Y, Z?
Yes.
I claim that should be in there. Here it is. Z, X, Y, Z.
XYZ
occurs in two different places, okay, and the fact that you can see that it occurs two different places is noticed by the fact that XYZ has two descendants, okay? XYZ dollar sign, meaning it occurs as the last three characters, and it also has a descendant XYZ, XYZ. So in fact, the number of descendants of XYZ tells you how many times that string occurred. Okay? So I don't know if that answers your question or not. Okay? But this suffix tree has more power than just telling you whether or not a string occurs. It tells you how many times it occurs. Right? Suppose you want to find how many times skeena occurs in, let's say, my book. There you're more likely to find it. Okay? Well, if you build a suffix tree of the book, okay, you search for skeena, S-K-I-E-N-A. If that is a leaf node, it occurred once. If you fell off the edge beforehand, it doesn't occur anywhere. If not, you're now at a node in the tree, and every leaf that is a descendant of that node is the number, a time where it occurred. So you can figure out not only did it occur, but by looking at the, the, the descendants of you, your descendants, you can figure out how many times, or if you annotate each position in the, each leaf with a position of where in the spring did it start, you can even figure out where it occurred. Okay? In time proportional to the number of matchings. Okay? So that's kind of an amazing thing. Okay? I'm not only going to learn that it occurred, but I can figure out where it occurred. Okay? Question? This algorithm does not have a name because we're not talking about it has a name, but it's not an algorithm. In some sense, I'm talking about a data structure. Okay? So there are other algorithms for doing string matching. You mentioned the word KMA. Knuth Morris Pratt is a famous algorithm for doing exact string matching. But that basically, the standard string matching algorithms take as input two strings and you ask, where does this occur? And that takes, when you do it right and using KMP or some other fast algorithm, will take time proportional to the two strings. But notice that an algorithm like that, a standard string matching algorithm, won't help you the second time you do a query. Let's say you want to see whether Skeena occurs in the text. By using the, one of the standard searching algorithms, in time proportional to the text and the query string, you could find where it existed. But if now if I ask you where does Alex exist in the book, okay, you have to scan through the entire book again, right? This suffix tree is a more amazing data structure in that it, once you build it, you can throw away the book and do the searches just on the text, on the tree. Okay? And you avoid the cost of searching the entire book over and over again. Okay? That's why this is an amazing data structure. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, question?
How do you claim like text in proportion to the length of the string? Because you're actually searching for all the nodes where you start from the
So how, you mean the question is, if I ask four, how many times does it, how much time, how am I going to defend my claim that I can find all the occurrences in time proportional to the length of the string? Well, that certainly I can't do in the sense that, the query string, in the sense that if I ask you how many times does A occur in the human genome, it occurs billions of times. So, but what I can make is a claim the following. That I can find all occurrences in the length of the pattern plus the time the number of times it occurs. Okay? So if you have a string that occurs only once.
No, I'm talking about just finding out if it occurs
or not. Okay, testing whether it occurs or not, I can do in time proportional, once I have built the suffix tree, testing whether it occurs, I can do in time proportional the length of the string very easily. Because I'm just going to walk down, and if I don't fall off the tree by the end of my pattern, then I know it exists.
Yeah, but you have to search all the children for the pattern, right?
Well, I have to search to decide, even when I hit a branching point, to decide whether I go to the left or to the right, which descendant do I go down? I do it, let's say I have to look at all my descendants. But how many descendants can any particular node have in this tree? What's the maximum number of descendants any node can have in the tree? Not the number of words in the string, so the number of letters in the alphabet. Okay? So if this was an English text, there might be 26 children to a node. If it was a DNA alphabet, there would be 4 children to a node. Okay? At each step, I'm going to have to look at 26 or 4 things, perhaps, to decide whether I can advance or whether I fall off the tree. But 4 and 26 are still constants to us. So in time proportional to...
We don't have like single character.
So the thing you've noticed here that may be a little confusing is, in fact, I have somehow compressed my tree here. Okay? I have sort of, if you wish, drawn this tree in a way that here I have, this edge is labeled not with a single character, but with a path X, Y, and Z. If I want, I could expand it. I could insert, replace this edge by a path, chain of single nodes, one X, one Y, one Z. So if it bothers you that it's compressed, it shouldn't really, because you can certainly easily go and expand it. But in fact, having it compressed is going to be an amazingly useful thing. Okay? Any questions, first of all?
But you won't be able to process it if that might be enough. If you have to use it, you have to use it. So is that like a single tree?
So right now what I have here is this single tree for now, and for purpose, let's say for today, let's think of it for now, my tree will be all suffixes of one string. Okay? The Bible, the human genome, something like that. Okay? What we do with it later is unimportant. Right now, right now think of a suffix tree as built on one string. In fact, you can merge suffix trees for multiple strings, and it doesn't really change the game. Okay, but for now, let's just think of it like that. Yes?
Just to confirm,
okay, so what is the compression that we have here? The answer is, I have compressed a suffix tree in a specific way that is kind of cute. First of all, whenever I have a chain of a path where there is no branching, for any node that has one child coming out of it, that is not a branching node, right? Those I'm going to collapse into one edge without any branching. So the only branches, the only nodes are going to be where there is a choice to make. Okay, that certainly seems more efficient in some sense. Okay? And what does that mean? I'm also going to do this in a maximal way. So that basically, the only branchings are going to happen when there is a character, when there is a choice of characters for that position. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Question? Okay, so if I want to find how many times, let's say that XY occurs in this tree, how can I find how many times XY occurs in this tree? Well, I walk down the path XY. It's going to take me two-thirds of the way down this edge on this particular example. Okay? I now say, okay, every place where XY occurs is going to be described by a descendant of this node. Does everybody sort of believe that? Okay. Now I'm going to switch from walking down the tree mode to explore all the descendants of that node. Right? So now if you know about tree traversal, remember in order, pre-order, post-order, grade traversal, if you're a computer science person, that's stuff you know. If you don't, we're simply going to go and walk down the tree and make sure we exhaustively explore, basically cut the tree at that edge, and now ask ourselves to visit every node that is below it. Okay? The number of leaves we encounter on that traversal is the number of times that it occurs. And if we have labeled each tree with the starting position of that suffix, that even tells us where it occurred. Okay? Question? Does it cost more to keep every node, you mean instead of keeping it in this compact form?
No, instead of traversing every time, just go to the node and see how many nodes are out there.
So one possibility, you're saying, suppose you want to know how many times it occurs. You don't care where it occurs, but you care how many times it occurs. There is no reason why you couldn't go back to every single node, do a traversal down the tree, count for every subtree how many times it occurs, and label that node with the number of occurrences. So you could, in fact, do a tree traversal to the bottom, say, look, every leaf occurs once. Every split point, that string is going to occur by the sum of the number of elements on the left, you know, of all of its descendants. I could compute that sum and stick that in that node if I wanted to. And so if I want, I could actually keep track of the number of counts, number of times any string occurs, without later, once I build this up, the data structure, ever having to go down to the leaves again. Does that answer your question, or are you... Well, of course, Not more in asymptotic sense. It means that I have to keep an, allocate an extra space for every node. So that costs more, but it's just a constant amount per node. In the big O sense of schemes, it doesn't cost you anymore. So if you want to do that, if you're going to be repeatedly asking myself, how often does this string occur? How often does this string occur? That's a good use of space to keep the counts at each node. Okay? Any questions? So there's a certain amount of flexibility you have here in how you want to do things, depending upon what operations you want to perform. Yeah? Doesn't take into account errors. We're not dealing with errors right now. Okay? We're dealing with exact matching for now. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Now, how much space does this data structure take into account? Okay, let's think about this. How many nodes will this tree have? Okay, let's think about it in the first case. Suppose we had an uncompressed tree. How many nodes might the tree, the uncompressed tree have? Okay. Does anybody have any ideas? As many as, what is the worst case if we leave it in an uncompressed form? It could be equal to the number, the sum of the length of every suffix. Right? Can anyone give me a string that would lead to a very, very big uncompressed suffix tree? Okay? What if, what was that? Suppose, let's say that we have a string that is, let's say we had a very large alphabet. Let's just try this very simply. Let's just say that we have a random string, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 string. What is going to happen? The first suffix we insert of, let's say, all the string, that's going to create n nodes, right? The second suffix we insert, how much is it likely going to share with the first suffix? Probably very little, right? Okay, if this was a random string 0, 1, 1, 1, the second suffix begins with 1. It shares nothing with that. That's now going to create n minus 1 nodes, right? The third string, if this is random, probably has very little in common with any of the first two suffixes, right? So it's going to branch off very quickly. If I give you a random string and I don't compress it, I claim almost every character in every suffix is going to appear as its own node. The more suffixes I add, the denser it is going to get up here. But odds are there's no long repeat anywhere in the string, right? If it's a random string, it probably does not contain any long repeats. The only savings you get would be if you had a long repeat to branch off of, right? So how many nodes would we expect, on average, would be in an uncompressed tree if a string was of length n? How much? N squared. Why n squared? Well, 1, n plus n plus 1, n minus 1 plus n minus 2, dot, dot, dot. That's going to be n terms, half of which are greater than n over 2. Right? So we have at least n 1 over 2 terms, which are each greater than n over 2. That sum is going to be greater than n squared over 4. Okay? So we've got an n squared thing going on. And this looks like big trouble. Okay? Because this tells me that the suffix tree we built for a string of length n looks like it's going to be very, very big, right? Now, is it a problem to store a suffix tree of the human genome of size 1 billion? Well, 1 billion is a lot of characters, sure. But no one, you know, rich enough biologists can buy a machine with a gigabyte of memory. Can a rich enough biologist buy a machine with a gigabyte squared of memory? Okay? The answer is no. So space, this quadratic space would seem like it's a big problem, right? Okay? So what can we do? Well, what if we store the string in this compressed format? Okay? where we only branch off when we have a, what you call, when there is in the tree a split, you know, a legitimate branching. Two possible suffixes that differ at that character. What do we know about the size of this tree? How many leaves does this tree have? Okay, how many leaves will this tree have? The number of the cyclic string or N. How many internal nodes will this string have, this tree have? Okay, let's think about this. If you have a tree with N leaves, how many internal nodes will it be? If every internal node has some real branching to it. Okay? Yeah? Less than 2N. Actually, I will claim less than N. N minus 1. Okay? Remember, this is sort of... let's think about this. If you have a tree which has legitimate branching to it, okay? What happens if I go to one node and any tree that has, N leaves. If you think about it, if your tree has two leaves, it's got to have a parent. Each one of these leaves, this leaf will have a parent that is a split. Deleting this one, okay, will reduce the number of leaves by one. If this node was of degree 2, had two nodes going out, now it no longer has a node going out, right? And we can sort of also, if you think of it, get rid of the internal node from there. The right proof of this is by induction, but I claim you've seen it if you've taken a basic graph theory course or data structures class. The number of internal nodes is going to be less than or equal to the number of leaves. So even in this compressed format, I have less than or equal to the number, I have N leaves and N nodes. The total amount of topological information in this graph is still linear in the size of the string, right? So a biologist who only has 1 gigabyte of memory still has a chance. He can certainly represent, he or she can certainly represent the tree topology in space linear in it. Does that include everything that we need in the suffix tree? How much space does it take to store this suffix tree? The topology, we agree, is linear in the number of the length of the string. Does everybody sort of buy that? Or if not, please ask. They're saying, I don't see why it's linear. I don't see why it's linear, okay? But what do we now know? The suffix tree has a leaf for every string in the for every suffix in the tree. Does everybody believe that? I'm not going to say that the total space I need if I ignore these labels. Okay, if I ignore the edge labels just to represent the tree. Okay, how many leaves will I have for a string of length n? N. Okay. How many internal nodes will I have in a binary tree? And this is even could be bigger than a binary tree, but it can't be worse. How many internal nodes will I have if I have n leaves? I say less than or equal to n. Notice if I have a tree, I know that it's bigger than a branching factor. Suppose that I have one node which branches out to n children. I have only one internal node for n leaves, right? So big branching factors reduce the need for internal nodes. But every branching factor is at least 2 in my compressed form, right? So basically, for every leaf, I have, by killing that leaf, I have one internal node I would kill. Okay? So the number of internal nodes is less than or equal to the number of leaves. So to represent the shape of the tree clearly requires order n space. Does everybody sort of buy that now? Okay, this is an amazing thing. The tree is, in fact, order n in size. But is that all the information I need, the shape of the tray? Or is there something else that I'm still missing? Okay, yeah?
You probably can store the information about roots and about edges in the time proportion of the hand by using some Bruker's code.
Well, what am I missing still?
The connection.
Well, the connection between the edges, that this vertex is adjacent to that vertex, that is also going to be linear. Why is that? If I have a tree with n vertices, how many edges do I have in that tree? I have n vertices, 2n vertices. In a tree with 2n vertices, how many edges do I have? Okay. The number of vertices minus 1, right? So I have 2n minus 1 edges. So actually just storing the black lines here, storing the edges, I still have only order n edges and order n vertices. So the topology of this tree is linear in the size of my spring. Does everybody buy that? That's not seemingly expensive. What is it that I still haven't told you where to store yet? The patterns on the edges. Now, potentially, I'm in trouble, right? Because each string here is a, you know, this is going to be a substring of the tree. Okay, I mean, this is going to be each edge is going to be labeled with a string. Okay, the string might represent lots and lots of characters. Okay? Suppose, let's say, we consider the suffix tree of our random, the compressed suffix tree of our random string. What is that tree going to look like? Okay, I mean, if I just think about it, you're going to have a topology that's probably going to be up at the top. All the labels are going to be pretty short, one character long. But eventually, you're going to hit the case where all the suffixes occur once. This is going to be n minus 5 characters long, and this is going to be n minus 7 characters long, and it's n minus, and this is going to be an edge label in the tree, right? So it looks like, how much might the total length of the edge labels be? N squared. Does everybody see that if I have to explicitly list that the length of those edge labels, I'm still in big trouble, right? It's still going to be n squared. Okay? Question. But do I have to actually keep those labels around? How can I avoid keeping these labels around? Okay, this is beautiful and clever. Okay? What I'm only going to do is the following. I'm going to keep one copy of the string, the input text, the Bible, the DNA genome sequence, the string that I'm building my tree for. Every edge label is really what? It's a substring in the tree, right? I could describe the substring of the tree by listing the characters A, C, T, T, G, 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 G. Or I could say, look it up in the string. It's the 25th through the 57th character. Okay? And then you go into the string and say, well, look, here's the 25th character, here's the 57th character. If you need that label, you can read it out now. Okay? What do I claim? If I give you each edge label not as a string by itself, but as a starting point and an ending point in the string, I claim two numbers will be enough to describe that string regardless of the length of the string. Does everybody see that? If you don't see it, this is beautiful, we should discuss it. Okay? If I keep this text, every one of these edge labels has the property that it is a suffix. Okay? That it is not a suffix, that it is a substring of the string, and once I have the text, it can be described by a starting point and an ending point. Okay? And that's all that she wrote. Any questions? So the amazing thing is here that I can store the suffix tree in space proportional to the original string. You need to keep the original spring, which is of length N. You need to keep N leaves. You need to keep N intermediate nodes. You need to keep N, two N edges. You need to keep, for every edge, two other numbers. So two times the number of edges. But the total space is linear. And I can do all these amazing things that seem like it should require quadratic space to do. Any questions? Okay? This is an amazing thing. Okay, I'm going to look more at what amazing things you can do with suffix trees, including using them to build an even more amazing theta structure next time. Any questions? Okay, thanks a lot. See you next class. Okay.